It is Saturday, September 10th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio KUSP. In the first half of the show, we'll cover the geek news of the week, and in the second half, we'll take your questions and comments about technology. You can call us up with anything you'd like today, and we'll answer that. I'll give out that contact information again when I give you out the phone numbers in about half an hour.
What,
no witty retort there, Miles?
Good said.
I could hear you wanting
super
to do
good
that.
Said.
The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. If you'd like to participate by making a song, please feel free to do so. Give us your song that you've made for us at geekspeak.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
We also have Mr. Ben Jaffe, freelance media guy. Hi.
Hey.
Ben, you've been busy with your show?
I've been super busy with my show, and it's going fantastically. If anyone didn't hear last week's episode and wants to see an awesome piece of theater, here after here at the Cabrillo Crocker Theater tonight and tomorrow matinee.
And the views expressed on this program are of the speakers,
opinion
not
of me.
KUSP.
Yeah,
the
KUSP doesn't endorse anything.
But you're having a good time doing the media. What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know. I wasn't trying to make a big statement. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, let's start with Mr. Miles Elam. Sir, what's interesting for the week of news for you?
Did you know that Google uses enough power at all times to power 200,000 homes? Uses that much electricity.
I didn't know they had
all the time.
Google, yeah.
200,000 homes.
Oof.
Yeah.
That's a lot of email. So equivalent with all their server farms and everything, you add that all up, it's equivalent to the 200,000 homes.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big city. I'm
yeah,
impressed.
That's larger than the electricity cost to Salt Lake City, for example.
Whoa. And they don't even do gambling. So this is just running their servers, I'm assuming?
Yep. Well, all of their infrastructure, but that's basically servers.
Yeah. Now, I heard that they do a lot of interesting tech in their server boxes. They're doing stuff like out on the sea. And I mean, I thought there was a lot of mystery and secrecy about what Google does. Or are they just publishing all their numbers at this point?
Out in the sea? I wasn't necessarily aware of that. And
I was listening to some program that talked about how they are doing server farms on barges.
I think that was a...
Potential.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think I read a news story about how they were thinking about... Google's always thinking about a lot of things that they don't do.
So is Google providing that much benefit to the world?
Well, there's the question. That's the argument Google wants to make. And this is something that I want to bring up just so people could see like this cost-benefit analysis. When you just look at the number of 200,000 homes,
that's a lot of electricity. Yeah.
In other words, 260 million watts.
Wow.
A million.
And I'm assuming there's probably a lot of redundancy in the system to make up for speed,
Certainly. And there are periods of time where they're not at peak usage.
Right.
Even though they are a worldwide company. But different data centers are going to have...
Fluctuations, right.
Fluctuations because they do have it geolocated. So
right.
Depending upon where you are in the world, you're going to go to a different...
And they do some smart things like shut machines down and bring them back up depending on need.
Yeah, with that much power, it's definitely in their best interest to try to maximize the power output.
That's a lot of advertising. I mean, they're making a lot of money. They pay everybody well. And on top of this, they have a lot of expense. It's interesting.
But there's another aspect to it.
Yeah.
Because we're using Google, because we're doing Google searches, and because we're doing YouTube videos and using Gmail, we don't get in the car to go to the library. We don't get in the car to go down to the various stores to do price checks.
Mm-hmm.
We don't, that type of thing. So
I can see that.
It's a real question as to whether or not it's a wash, like whether or not it's even a net benefit with the amount of energy required to do the alternative.
Yeah.
there's another piece of it that's in Google's favor as well, which is if you're hosting your own email server, let's say for your small business, mm-hmm. then, and this is according to their numbers that they published, you'll be using about 103 kilograms of CO2. Releasing 103 kilograms of CO2 every year. Whereas if you, let's say, use Google or something like that, according to their numbers, it'll be like 1.25 kilograms a year. So that's almost right. Two orders of magnitude.
And that makes sense because Google aggregates all of those numbers right. altogether. It's like someone trying to make chairs, and each person making their own chair is going to take a while, but you have a single craftsman that with an assembly line to make chairs,
mm-hmm. sure.
they're going to come up with a lot of them and have them be better chairs.
Mm-hmm. I can see that. I can see Google's argument for that. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that argument is not as strong when you talk about large server farms in general. You know, most corporations have large server farms for their content if they're not being hosted on Google systems. I see that it's probably better than turning on the computer in your mm-hmm. closet and keeping that running.
Yeah. Well, there are also a lot of companies just like Google that have these large distributed systems and things like Amazon, for example. Amazon sure. hosts so many different. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So many different companies. Websites and services.
Well, thanks. Well,
yeah, and that actually is a curious thing that comes up with regard to cloud computing.
Yeah.
That notion of it's just servers off somewhere in the net or a group of cluster of servers.
Not our problem. It kind of just works.
You go to a website and you put in your stuff and it just works and you don't have any infrastructure of your own. We've talked about that in the past in terms of the lack of control that you have over your data, but at the same time, is the cloud going to put in huge increases in efficiency and decreases in electricity usage per unit
of course
of
it does
work,
I would assume it would, because of course the business is to make it cheap and therefore less cost,
but that is something that and especially because a lot of cloud computing is done through other sources like Amazon's EC2 service, mm-hmm. Their AWS. Even those aggregated services are now aggregating onto other services.
But that philosophical perspective of, you know, where am I going to put my photographs of my family? Am I going to put them all in the cloud? Do I have local copies? Or my blog entries as I write stuff, as I become a member of the communities I'm a part of, the content that I create, if I don't have it locally and I have it somewhere in the cloud, the idea of there's a philosophical concern there to some degree. I mean, a writer keeps the copy of their manuscript, right? They trust their publisher; they get a copy of their book. But in this digital space where everything's online, your Facebook account, for example, all the content that you have there and you've created there, that doesn't it belongs to in the theoretical sense, but it's not a part of something you control. It can be turned off and erased tomorrow,
right?
And so that idea, and as a society, we're putting more and more of our knowledge in that kind of non-controllable right. space.
And I've had that happen to me before with a couple of blogs, where some blogs I just like let go foul, and I'm like, huh, I wonder what I wrote. I should like save that stuff. And I went back to Blogspot, and it wasn't there anymore.
Did the Wayback Machine have it?
Oh, I forgot to check there.
Archive.org.
Yeah, I would go check there.
Archive.org is a really wonderful organization that's trying to archive all of human knowledge. And if you go to archive.org, you can look at the Wayback Machine. It shows you web pages by history, and you can see older content. Pretty neat stuff.
Yeah, although technically they're not allowed to do it through copyright. And so if anyone has a copyright, they can tell archive.org, hey, don't save any of this stuff from our company, right. Which is, it's a shame.
I agree. I think it's a neat ability to have a kind of a timestamp on humanity's early web development. They can't, of course, copy everything. There's too much content, so it's not a successful endeavor in that sense.
It is very cool, though, to like go to Time.com, Time Magazine, or whatever, and then go to the archive.
Yeah.
Go to archive.org and type in Time.com and see all of the different iterations their website's gone through.
Cool.
Now, I should just say I haven't actually done that with time.com. So if it doesn't work, try something else.
Right. And that's where I see archive.org being very, very similar to libraries, the role that libraries mm-hmm. have played. That as books come out, as content is produced, that you have this archive that is kept for people to go and share and check.
It looks like GeekSpeak first got snapshot on December 12th, 1998. And the page just says, every Monday night at 6:30 p.m., Geek Speak Radio. Ooh, that was the name of the show originally.
Geek Speak Radio.
Geek Speak Radio. Very cool.
Did you really just use snapshot as an adjective?
Yeah, you did.
What'd I say?
Geek Speak first got snapshot.
Sorry. any case, very cool history. We actually are, I guess this month is our 11th year doing the show, right, Miles? September?
Yes. You are actually 11 years plus 1 month, and I'm at 11 years.
Well, congratulations. Thanks for doing Geek Speak for 11 years.
I don't know. I did the solo show 2 weeks ago for the first time. Like the first time there was ever really a solo show. You've done one where you did recordings ahead of time, but and we've had times where we pre-recorded and someone was sitting in here just playing it.
Yep.
But it was the first time we ever did a one-man show, or I ever did a one-man show.
You did take calls, though.
I did take calls, that's true. And it was also a very clear sign that, yeah, Geek Speak is about a group of geeks.
Conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we won't go back into that. If you want to hear the episode of Miles being very brave, please feel free to look at our archive.
And me saying, an awful lot when I went back to listen to it. It was horrible.
Well, you know, when Ben starts talking about his news story, I listen to it, but I'm also halfway getting ready for the next thing, right? So without being here, how would you do that? It's very difficult. Ben, what is the thing
now
you're
I'm
distracting
all
with?
Subconscious, yeah. Self-conscious.
I'll keep eye contact with you the entire time.
Yeah. Oh, God, that's going to be more awkward. You know, actually, Lyle and I were talking, you and I were talking about how we can type in passwords without looking at the keyboard and just like carry on a conversation while we're typing in passwords and things like that.
Even my new 36-digit password.
And it's got to feel so awkward for people who just can't do that, hunt and peck with their pointer fingers, you know, on the keyboard.
Oh, yeah. If you don't know how to teach yourself to touch type. It's not extremely hard.
It's one
hard.
Of the best skills you'll ever awesome. Learn. That's true.
Yeah, I switched to a very long password recently. I don't even know how many digits it is. But I decided to set that to my screensaver password and my lock in my machine. And man, when I am tired or like laying on the side of my bed trying to do it, I can't do it. I have to like sit up. I stretch my eyes out a little bit. I'm like looking at okay.
But then you can't lose the rhythm.
No, no. If you lose the rhythm, I forget it. Like I'm not even thinking about the characters they are, right? I've memorized at this point where it's a
muscle
body.
Memory.
Yeah, muscle body. If I try to think of what it actually is, I'll mess myself up. It's really horrible. And forget it. If you wanted to put it on if you gave me a different type of keyboard, I wouldn't be able to enter my password. But anyway, it's a temporary thing.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's move on to your story. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I interrupted you introducing my story, so how awkward is that?
All right, Miles, your turn.
So there's this company called Vicon Energy, and they have this idea of using basically regenerative braking for trains. Because it turns out when a train pulls into a station, stops, you lose all of that kinetic energy, right? And then when they start going again, they actually uses, speaking of energy and Google and everything, it uses a tremendous amount of energy to get up to cruising speed. It uses...
tremendous amount of electrical power.
Sorry. Like New York subway system, for example, if you have a 10-car subway train, it will require 3 to 4 megawatts of power for 30 seconds to get the train up to its normal cruising speed. That's actually a decent amount of power, especially when you're running as many trains as the New York subway runs all the time. And so, you know, like the issue is, one, we're wasting a lot of power. And two, how do you mitigate this problem of accidentally pulling too much power? And so sometimes a lot of these systems, these big ones like London, New York, actually have to stagger their trains as they're accelerating.
Oh, interesting.
So you know, you might be sitting on a train, the doors close, and it sits there for 15 seconds, and then it goes, and that might just be because there's just not enough power to pull to get this train going.
So they only want a couple trains taken off at one time.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Like if you've got multiple toasters in your house, you can only use one at a time.
Or hair dryers.
Right, exactly.
Or hair,
so
whatever.
So that is a lot of power. What's their, besides staggering, is there another solution?
Yeah, there is a solution. And that's what Vicon Energy is talking about. They make really humongous industrial flywheels. And yeah, flywheels are those things where like you've got a lot of momentum, massive things moving fast or something,
rotational
right?
Rotational mass, yes.
Rotational, not rotational.
Angular momentum.
Angular, no.
Well, no, it's the flywheel.
Kinetic
a lot of, okay. Yes, it's big, a lot of kinetic energy.
A big kinetic energy.
To potential energy.
You know, it's stupid. I just totally lost that phrase. I just used it like 30 seconds
too
ago.
Much rehearsing.
So you've got, yeah, right. So you've got all this kinetic energy, these huge, massive trains, and you want to stop them, but you want to also capture that energy. And so the Priuses, for example, do that just by using the electric motor as a generator, right? And it uses that generator as a brake. And stores all of that inside of, I guess, a giant battery, maybe
a
capacitor.
Just a battery.
Well, instead of storing it as electrical, as power in a battery, what they're doing
chemical
instead...
Chemical energy.
What they're doing is they've got these flywheels, and they're thinking about basically somehow, and I don't know how they're mechanically going to do this, but attaching the train to something which pulls on this flywheel and basically winds it up like a gigantic spring, you know?
Well, starts it spinning.
It starts spinning.
It's funny, this story, in the 11 years of doing Geek Speak, we did this story 6 years ago with Metro buses. Same idea. The danger, of course, was that in a bus, if you've got this giant, massive spinning thing and an accident happens, what happens?
Well, actually, I was thinking more along the lines of, if you have this massive spinning thing in a bus, it's very hard to turn.
Right.
Especially in a particular direction. Like, it may be really easy to turn left,
well,
but
I think,
very hard to turn right.
I think you make sure the flywheel's not going vertical. You make the flywheel go horizontal, uh-huh. And then it's not going to have an effect on the spin.
Right, and then stopping is much harder.
Wait, are we designing a flywheel right now? Or?
Yeah,
so as it turns out, my father worked on these systems. Yes, my father has actually used to work on train systems that had a flywheel, type of technology.
Oh, cool.
And this was 30 years ago.
Now, are these flywheels going to be at the stop? At the stops or on the trains?
They're
going to
be at the stations themselves, right?
See, that makes a lot more sense.
Exactly. So you don't have this crazy, really, really fast, spinny thing, which probably, they're probably going to be heavy and stuff, too.
And then you have to use electricity to move.
In the train. Yeah, exactly.
Right. And for that matter, trains have to turn left and right.
This is true. So basically, all of this rotational energy will be turned back into electrical energy delivered to the train via the...
Energy or just physical energy?
Electrical energy.
Really?
And then
the
deliver
on electricity.
Mm-hmm. No, I know, but I don't know why you have
to power the train to accelerate it.
Not if you have giant spinning wheel that you can just push the train forward. See, that's how I thought they were going to do it.
Then you have to build a giant hand to push the back of the train.
Have you heard of wheels spin?
But what's so cool about this is, according to the company spokesman, he said we can put back 90% of what we capture.
Yeah, that's very
90%.
Cool.
That's really good. Yeah. That's substantial.
So it's probably not converting to electricity. It's probably motion to motion.
No, it's not a bad efficiency. So the idea is that
It's going through the electric third rail. Cool. That's how it's delivering it to the train. So it is going to electricity.
So they don't have to do a battery. They don't have to do chemical storage. They don't have to do a capacitor. Mm-hmm. They're doing a mechanical storage.
The train, you have to do a mechanical to electrical.
No. To break the train, you just...
Mechanical to the flywheel.
Then you get the flywheel.
Okay,
moving.
So then it's mechanical.
Yeah. Okay,
mechanical,
so mechanical. So imagine the Lego scene. I always like doing the translation to toy kind of thing. Basically, you're talking the train and pushes along, and where the stop is, there's this giant wheel that can touch the side of the train or whatever. And when it touches, the train slows down to match the same speed as the flywheel. The flywheel speeds up. So by the time the train is stopped, the flywheel is spinning really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're ready to go, they just connect the flywheel with a clutch of some kind to a motor that generates a whole bunch of electricity because the motor all of a sudden kicks into gear and that electricity then charges the motor on the train. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And this is why we don't have one-man shows.
Last week's episode is why we don't have one-man shows. Oh, wait. Was that 2 weeks ago?
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm all confused about that, too. Last week it was you and I.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yes, it was.
It was a two-man show.
Yeah, we didn't give away anything. Yeah. It was bad, too.
But anyway, so I mean, if you can put back 90% of what you capture, even 85%, that is a significant decrease in, one, the amount of power you're using, and two, the strain you're putting on the power grid. So, I mean,
also have the benefit of having the localized energy source, right? You don't have to transport that electricity a long distance with all that loss because you're generating it right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true. One other thing I just wanted to mention, these flywheels are so cool. They've got these flywheels that have these magnetic bearings. So instead of ball bearings, and the ball bearings are spinning around at about half the speed as the flywheel is spinning, I mean, that's fast. These get
but
up to
like a fair amount of friction.
10,000 RPM, 20,000 RPM, you know, some
that's
of the ones that they
speeds.
Or higher even. And so if you just don't have anything connecting the flywheel to the infrastructure around it, that'd be kind of cool. So they actually make these magnetic things.
So it's like floating on top of just magnetic force.
Yeah. Kind of like,
so it's a question of it's making that an electromagnet that can keep it at least, you know, a fraction of a millimeter above the surface as part, like how much power that requires, and that's your overhead.
Now,
I wonder
if it's funny.
Electromagnet. It might be static magnets doing it.
It very possibly could be, yeah. Because if it was an electromagnet, then you would just really not want the power to go out, because then your little wheel would destroy
itself. Well, that's the thing, though. As the wheel is putting out, you can have some excess power being used for self-sustaining. So while it's spinning, it's sustaining its own levitation.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And so if the power goes out, it would only be when it's stopped, and then it would be at low velocity or stopped.
So are they implementing these things? Or just testing them? What's the deal?
Well, they're talking about it. They're talking about it. I'm not sure what the plans. I mean, they have a plan. They have some plans, in particular for New York, London, and Paris. I think are the people they're talking to, and it'll just be, we'll just see what happens with it.
All right. I'm covering a story from CNN about a wonderful little device that is called a Skynet. It's a Skynet bot, and it flies through the air detecting Wi-Fi and electrically attacking it, cybernetically attacking it, if you will.
And then starts developing the Terminator.
Basically. So you guys are familiar with what Skynet, of course, is from Terminator movie. It's the little, it's the way the world ends.
I'm too young.
The
robot
apocalypse.
That.
And this thing basically,
wow,
this is a Wi-Fi device, a Wi-Fi detecting and cracking system that's put on top of a Parrot.
A Parrot?
Parrot. AR drone. So it's one of those quadricopters.
Not like a
copters.
Squawking Parrot.
No, I don't think so. And this whole system looks like it could be built for about $600. The idea behind it is this. Most people's home networks are, the Wi-Fi is just open because, you know, who's going to come and sit at your doorstep and look through your content? So we're always talking about having a router at the front of the internet, if you will, that protects you. And then after that, you put a Wi-Fi in. And then your local computers are relatively safe from the internet. And this would be a relatively cheap device that could fly around a neighborhood, find a Wi-Fi access point, and then hack into your machines through your Wi-Fi. So it's probably better to start dealing with good Wi-Fi security. Have it locked down. Use WPA, WPA2 for your Wi-Fi. Because who knows? There might be flying drones that attack your network relatively soon. You really could build this for
terrifying.
But don't worry. They'll only do it by infrared. They can't look down, so you can just hit the ground and
right. You can just crawl around. They won't see. Yeah, that's right.
My God, you guys are geeks.
Yeah, if you got that joke, you're a geek. If you didn't, there's still hope for you.
This is from the Stevens Institute. The professor, the lead professor, is Sven Dietrich. In any case, if you want to learn more, it's at geekspeak.org.
Dietrich, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fine.
Just saying. That's usually how that's pronounced.
Geeks Beyond KSP is supported by Cruise.io Internet, offering commuters quiet drop-in office space with a 10 gigabit fiber internet connection at 877 Cedar Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Information is at cruise.io.com. You're listening to Geekspeak. The geeks today are me, Lyle Troxell, Ben Jaffe, and Miles Elam.
Also known as the evil geek.
And for the geek bit today, Ben's got a little story. A little something something.
Yes, I do. Either of you heard of Smozy?
No.
Okay, so Smozy is a way of surfing your T-Mobile network without a data plan. So you can actually, now this is probably going to be closed, this loophole. But basically, instead of buying a data plan and everything like that, if you have unlimited texting, you can send data out, you can receive data, so like from people. So why not receive it from computers? Why not send a packet request for a particular website to a server out there somewhere, and then the server downloads the website and sends it back to you in an MMS, in a multimedia text message. So basically what they're talking about, what this app is doing, is completely subverting having to have a data plan to browse the internet. Does
it's
that
also,
make sense?
It's changing. It's also changing the default packet size on the net to something that fits into an SMS.
So you're saying you don't get network. You just get text messing text with multiple messages. You get that unlimited. And then instead of saying, hey, Google, with your web browser, you text a message that says Google search.
Yeah,
and
I want to go to geekspeed.org.
And then it responds back with images to your... That just sounds horrible. Thank you very much for that news story.
It actually works relatively well. It's really slow, obviously. But I mean, if you need the internet and you don't have data...
Yeah, that's cool.
And you only go to lightweight sites that load very quickly, like geekspeak.org.
Do you have another geek bit, Miles?
Yes, I do. How many listeners out there were aware that carrots have only really been orange since the 17th century?
All carrots?
Or rather, mid-17th century. Yeah.
That's silly.
For centuries, almost all carrots were yellow, white, or purple.
Wow.
And it was only in the 17th century.
Someone discovered carotene and said, wait a second.
No. When people wanting to give tribute to William of Orange, man who led the struggle for Dutch independence, they started cultivating orange carrots, which were very rare at the time.
Wait, it's a political statement? The carrot?
They were probably crossing European or Eastern carrots, which were purple, with Western carrots, which were white and red, and trying to get them together to make an orange carrot. And all the other carrot varieties, basically, were wiped out within a single generation.
Whoa.
They had been around for thousands of years.
As a popular source. Wow. I'm going to go eat a carrot and try to find a purple one.
So carrots being orange? Yeah. Totally arbitrary. It's all
politics.
That's
insane. You know.
GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by All RV Service in Scotts Valley at its new location at 155L. Read this whole thing from the beginning. With your mouth at the very top right there.
GeekSpeak on KOSP, supported by All RV Service in Scotts Valley at its new location at 155 El Pueblo Road behind Scarborough Lumber. All RV offers service, parts, and rentals online at allrvservice.com or 461-1777.
We are now taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number to call is 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any of your calls you'd like. If it's tech support you're desiring, please do so. If you want to correct something we've said on the show, we'd love it. Like somebody should have called last week when Ben mentioned that a supernova just happened that happened to be 21 million light years away.
You're listening to KUSB, Central Coast Public Radio.
And here we are right now taking a call from a listener, Sean in Santa Cruz. Hi, Sean. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
How you guys doing? It's Sean Terrio. It's a blast from a past.
Hey, how's it going?
Going well, man. How you guys doing?
We're doing good.
So I woke up this morning, started listening to you guys, and you just happened to be talking about my area of expertise, which is data centers.
Oh, I thought it was about flywheels.
Well, that too, because a lot of data centers are actually using the flywheel generators so that they don't have to have a diesel generators and the UPS uninterruptible power supply systems.
So in a power fault, everybody has these DC generators or propane generators that come on, but it takes a while for them to actually start producing electricity. So you have to have something for that short period of time. And one of those ways is a giant battery pack that kicks in. And the other way to do
which
it
is very expensive.
The other way to do it is to have this giant flywheel running. And when the power turns off, the flywheel connects to a motor and instantly provides power. It's a very cool way of doing it. Do these flywheels and generators, are they connected together? Does it actually start up the DC the generator?
So the flywheels are actually they serve two purposes. So instead of having the battery backup systems, they have the flywheels constantly going and constantly running because the power is being fed through them through the UPSs.
Uh-huh.
So it serves as a UPS and the battery backup system. They're in a handful of data centers. Some people love them. Some people don't. There have been a number of outages with them in a handful of different data centers. But then again, all data centers at some point eventually have an outage.
So what you're saying is the power coming into the building gets generated it starts generating a flywheel that rotates, and that flywheel then runs a motor. So you basically have a physical coupling of electricity flow into your system.
That's correct.
Wow,
right.
That's really cool.
Yep. But what I was thinking is you could put one of those things onto a train. You could have whole separate section on the train with that on the train. So instead of having it separated in its own separate yard where you're feeding the electricity from, why not put it on the train?
Well, I think they're talking about putting it at I think they're talking about putting it at the station stops.
At the individual stations.
And because the train systems are so closed and there's only a certain amount of train stations, it means that you don't have to propel these things, and you actually don't have to have as many. Because you only need to have one for each stop, not one for every train. So I think it makes more sense to... Right. And then, of course, the whole problem of having to accelerate and decelerate all this mass. Not, I'm talking about the angular acceleration, but I'm talking about the train itself. So I think that's why they're doing it at the stops. But,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
But that's a lot of... You said, like, it takes about 3 megawatts for 30 seconds.
Yeah, it's like 3.5 megawatts, yeah.
That is a ton of power.
Yes, it is.
Power. That's not the hard drive.
It's a lot of it's a lot of people, a lot of mass you have to move from a dead stop.
Yeah.
It's a ridiculous amount of power.
Superman is really strong.
The last thing I want to leave you guys with, and I don't know if you've talked about this already, but it's the whole IPv6 versus IPv4 reality that's happening right now, and there's a huge forklift upgrades that are going on across the internet, and there's all sorts of tools being developed by actually a local company and a local guy who you've probably heard of, Aaron Hughes. There's a company that's called SixConnect, and it's an IPv6 management tool. So I don't know if you guys have talked about that, but with IPv6 also comes all sorts of new loopholes and security threats that we haven't even thought about yet, right?
Right. We've slowly hardened IPv4 right. over the years, and now we've got very sophisticated hacking with a completely new system.
Right, and we get rid of some of the holes with IPv4, so some of our knowledge that we spend so much time with, like, for example, port scanning, or like when you're searching for an IP, searching a subnet, just doesn't work anymore because every subnet is going to have millions of possible ports. It's just, it's not feasible anymore, but yeah, so... Throw out all the old stuff, and
we talk about it a little bit. Of course, it's a pretty complicated subject, so it's always a challenge how much tech you get into on a radio show. And but I think it'd be fun to talk to maybe Aaron too.
It feels like quantum physics.
It does feel
everything you knew was wrong? We're still kind of working out what's there now,
but it works. It's 'cause to me, it feels like. You know, you're in junior high, and you kind of figure out the social structures. You know where you're going to sit. You know where you're going to eat. Everything's going to be okay. No one's going to beat you up today. And then you start your freshman year, and it all goes out the window. You got to learn it all again. So anyway, yeah, IPv6. That's cool. I didn't know that Aaron was doing it. I know Aaron's really involved a lot in that kind of space. And in fact, Flash in the past, I haven't spoken with Aaron or you in a few years since last you guys were on the show. How are you feeling about IPv6 as someone that deals with data centers? Is it a pain for you, or is it painful and like wake you up with cold sweats, or is it going according to plan?
None of it's going according to plan. it's taken forever to people. Like, I mean, you laid it out there. It's taken forever for people just to finally get their grasp around how to manage IPv4. So with the advent of IPv6, which now has, you know, an infinite more number of variables involved with it, it's going to be, you know, it makes for some very interesting times.
And it also makes for some wonderful business opportunities. If you are a network engineer or a general application programmer working with network apps, if you can grok IPv6 and make apps for that, you are looking at another gold rush similar to saw for the dot-com boom.
So literally on that note, that's exactly what Aaron Hughes is doing. And he's right here in town. He's got a handful of other guys that work over the hill. They just raised $2 million, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
As there's more need to have IPv6, more and more hardware is going to be upgraded to IPv6, more networks going to be that way. And you're going to find that there are many applications that they kind of work in, you know, with the IP4 to IPv, the 4 to 6 bridges, but... You're going to start seeing a lot of need for, like, is your application IPv6 compliant, and so, people that have that knowledge. So that's where to go, folks.
So I think that's a great suggestion, Miles. It's definitely going to be a lot of money in that space. It makes a lot of sense. We're forced into going to IPv6, even though it's been planned for a long time, because we're out of IPv4 numbers in the public space.
Because we've been dragging our feet and taking forever to do it.
Because it's complicated.
It's just like Y2K. We dragged our feet, and finally in those last two or three years...
Lots of people made money.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah, nothing will probably happen bad, but it's definitely a space for innovation, a space for making some dough. And just to be clear, IP, we're talking about the internet protocol. It's the actual protocol the entire internet runs on top of. When you talk about the internet stack, that's what we're talking about. The IPv4... If you've ever entered in a set of one, two, or three digit numbers, four of them separated by periods, so 128.164.55.4.
If you have a home router, most of the time it's been something like 192.168.0.1.
Or 10.0.0.1. And you've entered those kind of numbers in the router, and you're like, that's what we're talking about, the IP version 4. And those are actually short numbers compared to the new version of IP version 6.
Right.
And the protocols work really differently.
IPv4 allows for a little over 4 billion numbers. And when you think that we're about to hit 7 billion people on the planet.
4 billion ain't enough.
Yeah, 4 billion ain't enough. Especially when we all have like a laptop and a smartphone and a home computer.
I decided to count up like IPs that I'm kind of myself deal with. And I probably have 12 IPs just for me, you know, my phone. And my
IPv6 means that we could allocate probably like a million IP addresses per grain of sand on all the beaches on the planet.
But as very clear by Sean, by your call, and also what Aaron Hughes is doing and what Miles is talking about, the issue is that all the ways that you deal with the management of the protocol, they're all different. DHCP doesn't exist in the new space, right? So these fundamental ideas just are totally different.
There's an allocation scheme. It's just
it's
different.
Just not called DHCP.
It's different.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you.
When every person, every toaster, you know, every living thing inside of your house, in your office, in your car has an IP address, how do you manage that?
Yeah, we don't rely on NAT anymore to act as our firewall. We actually have to have a real firewall.
You know, I think it's really interesting, like the idea that, of course, there's going to be security concerns. You bet there's going to be security concerns, you know? My toaster BIOS was just updated, and now my fridge isn't working. Like, there's some serious problems as you connect everything. But we're going that route. Well, thank you, Sean, for the call.
No pun intended.
Yes, two puns in the show. Thanks, Sean, for the call.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for everything you do.
Take care. From Watsonville, where we're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. The number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877.
And we promise to answer even though we might not be right.
That's right. From Watsonville, Robert, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, I have a small but annoying problem. Whenever I play a DVD, it stutters briefly about halfway through the movie.
On your computer?
Yep. I'm playing Windows XP.
And it's halfway through any movie you're playing?
About right around. It's not exactly the same place.
How long does it stutter?
About 4 to 8 seconds.
And then it continues to play and everything's fine for a long period of time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a background process taking processor time, I would assume.
What does that mean?
That's my guess. So it means that there's something on your computer that around that period of time is doing something.
It's sucking up a bunch of CPU time.
Right. So your computer actually takes a lot of resources being used to play a DVD on a computer because of this whole wonderful decryption problem.
Yeah, and if you thought that was bad, you just see Blu-rays. Ooh, that's a lot of CPU.
So if your machine has to do something else for a short period of time, like send spam out to 6,000 people, it might stutter.
Uh-oh.
No, you probably, probably don't have a virus.
That
would be a network issue, though. That's not CPU.
It happens with a lot of different disks, a lot of different times.
Yeah. I think it's probably unrelated to the DVD software, and it's probably unrelated to the DVD itself. It probably is something completely. Your machine is doing something else during that period of time. Does anyone in the room know how to see what else has happened during that time?
Well, you could always try booting. You should be able to boot in safe mode, right? And then run the DVD.
Maybe safe mode is definitely limited.
You can probably end up with speed issues there because then you're not going to have your optimized drivers for I/O.
Right, that's true, but it'll be more consistent.
It'll be consistently bad.
Yeah. So if you boot in safe mode and it's consistently bad and you don't get the drop frame thing, then it's probably something running in the background. And
keep in mind, XP is very quickly reaching its end of life cycle.
Right.
I would do if I had an XP machine, and I do you do a lot of software that's only available on Windows?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, how old is your machine? That's another question.
About 4.5 years old.
That's not bad. That's still.
You might want to take a look at the specs on it and see if you can run Windows 7.
I can.
I would go ahead and upgrade your machine to Windows 7.
Get a new machine.
That sounds good. That's still an SATA drive, and it's still the CD-ROM would still be or DVD-ROM drive would still be PATA.
The other thing to do is to take a look at extra applications you've running, especially in the taskbar and any applications that run at startup. getting rid of as many of those as possible will help speed up machine performance in general. Not having other applications running in the background is very beneficial to.
Well, it's got 2 gigabytes of RAM and 3.4 gigahertz of speed. So
yeah, but this
slaps more RAM in it. Wouldn't hurt. I mean, if it's a swap, if something's touching a swap file, and it wouldn't touch swap files.
No, those are pretty beefy specs. Like there's something else going on there.
2 gigs is beefy.
With a 3 gig processor just to play a DVD,
Something else is running.
One other thing.
Do you have virus protection software?
AVG.
One other thing you could do is make yourself another user account and then log into that user account and try playing it.
Good.
Because then you won't have any of the programs that you had installed before
as
running.
User. Yeah.
It'll just be a completely clean install. And that'll tell you if it's a software thing or if it's a hardware thing.
Well,
we're
talking about XP here. So people always install and they're running as administrator, which means that there's a lot of system processes.
Most of the time, something you could try.
And lots of times, of course, the software gets installed is actually running not as that user in the space.
Yeah, there are utilities.
AVG, though, could be the problem. There could be that AVG is kicking in to do a scan.
I don't understand how it could be the problem because I've had the software AVG for a long time, and I've had the DVD running.
And this is a new thing.
Yeah, not unless, sketchy to me.
The real question is what's changed. Yeah.
What are the names of the programs? I forgot off the top of my head that you go in, they do registry cleanup, they look at all the software that's installed and lets you choose like which things are started up.
I haven't done XP in so long.
One thing you can do is run Spybot Search and Destroy to see if you have any malware running, but it's probably not the issue.
I know Norton Symantec have something that
malware
does that.
Spybot, AVG.
So the big thing to focus on is that it's not the DVD player or the DVD software, right? I really think it has to do with something else in your machine.
But I don't think it's malware either.
I don't think it is either. I think you'd see a lot more badness if it was malware.
I also ran a USB drive with AVG on it before Windows booted up, and there was no malware.
You're probably fine on that. It really has to do with something in your system decides, hey, I'm going to do something right now.
Yeah, if there's any listener out there that remembers what some of these software, especially if it's a piece of free software, because all you're checking to see is what things are loading on startup and being able to disable them one by one.
Well, I do have 61 processes.
Some of them are necessary. You can do a search on those processes if you're not sure which ones. The other thing, you can run the task manager while you're playing the DVD and see if while the DVD skips, if you can tell which thing just grabbed a lot of processor time.
Oh, excellent.
Right? That would be the way to go.
So sort by CPU time.
Sort by CPU speed time and then run your DVD and see if you can get it to duplicate it.
By memory as well. You can sort by memory
diagnose what's going on first.
Yeah.
Before you
All right, good luck. Let us know. And if anyone knows Windows XP tricks on this kind of sort, please let us know. We're going to take the next call. Thank you so much, Robert.
Thank you.
From Santa Cruz, John, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Have you been sitting idle waiting for it to come on the air with us?
Not quite idle. I've been doing some little...
You've been actively spinning and ready to talk about flywheels?
Yeah.
All right, go ahead.
This is a really interesting subject, so I got on Google and looked around, and I found this website of kinetic traction systems. I don't know if that's where you guys were looking. But they say, we developed these flywheels for trains and stuff, and they give some numbers on their website of how much energy they actually store, and they say one of them stores 1.5 kilowatt hours usable energy, approximately 1.5 kilowatt hours, which actually is a very small amount of energy. That's about 30 cents worth of energy, and maybe a couple of, roughly the order of a car battery.
I wouldn't say it's roughly the order of a car battery. I'd have to do the calculations on that. But there's not that much.
Kilowatt hours and watts are different things. Watts is basically instantaneous, but over 1 second of power versus a kilowatt hour, which is a cumulative over time. So
it's true that it's only like 30 cents, and a kilowatt hour is not that expensive. But it's actually like quite a bit of power. I mean, especially if you try to, use it instantaneously like the train is doing.
Yeah, if you're gathering all that power over the course of 15 seconds as the train slows down or something like that, then it might be more substantial.
1 kilowatt hour, you can run your house pretty effectively, your entire house, for a few seconds. That's a lot of power.
That's a lot of energy. Kilowatt hours is a unit of energy.
So do you want to say something else about that, John?
So just the numbers, like 30 megawatts for 30 seconds is about that amount of energy could be stored in about 10 car batteries. So I think this technology is really interesting idea, but right now at the scale it is, it's nowhere near as car battery.
Well, that's the thing, is that how long you can't get that kind of power out of a car battery without the battery melting. it's about the speed of delivery, right? So that's how much power is in the battery, but you can't draw it out that fast.
Right.
Like you can take a AA battery, and you know, there's actually quite a bit of power in it. You put a wire right across it, it's going to heat up the wire, but it won't fry the wire like if you took all that energy in a capacitor and threw it out instantaneously. But the flywheel acts much more like a capacitor. It's just that it also, besides the moving parts, which you can eliminate, of course, with these frictionless ball bearings because of you know, magnetic ball bearings, you're really dealing with a lot more power storage and return quickly. And that's what they need for the train, not the ability to do it you know, with car batteries, but the ability to do it really, really fast.
Sure, but the reason I'm bringing up car batteries, you can deliver it much faster than you could with a wire that's going to melt. But the amount you can deliver currently is about the amount that would be stored up in a car battery. So how fast is that going to get a train moving? It's about, you know, they're talking about 30.
Well, the ones that Ben's story was talking about was designed specifically for these larger trains.
Yeah, so they're like industrial size.
Well, I got this information from the train.
Same thing. Well, we're going to post the news stories pretty soon. We'll, if you send that to us via at geekspeak.org, we'll make sure to include that in our notes as well.
We'll send you a link to that website.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your show.
From Salinas, James, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hey, guys. How you guys doing?
Good.
I had a suggestion for the earlier user that had a problem running a video CD.
Robert in Watsonville.
Yeah, there's this great program that I got from a geek friend of mine called, it's free, you can Google for it, it's called CC Cleaner. So it's two C's and then cleaner, and it has a whole bunch of utilities that you can run to see what's going on with your system. One of them is manipulating what is starting up.
Yeah, great. That's exactly the kind of tool that Miles was talking about. So CC Cleaner, it's by Piriform, and we'll have a link on it from geekspeak.org. And basically, it allows you to do a whole bunch of tasks that, you know, clean up your machine. And one of those cleanup processes to limit the amount of processes, programs that are running in the background. And this thing will kind of help you determine what you can get rid of and what you can't. Thank you. We'll link to it. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call, James. Take care.
All right,
I love when we were able to ask a question to the geeks.
Yeah, and I was actually doing some quick calculations. He was talking about 1.4 kilowatts, kilowatt hour, sorry.
Yeah.
I did a calculation for how much that would be for an instant, if you got all that energy out instantaneously or over 1 second.
Over 1 second, okay. Good.
Yeah, over 1 second, one in wattage.
Uh-huh.
And it would be 5 megawatts.
Five megawatts for 1 second. Very cool.
Yes, so you would probably need more than 1.4 kilowatt hours in storage,
right?
But it's the right ballpark.
Yeah, very cool. From Monterey, Ed, welcome to Geekspeak.
Hey, how you guys doing? I'm on speakerphone. Is that working all right?
It's fine. What's up?
Okay, so recently went from Ethernet through DSL using Redshift, and I went to airport Wi-Fi, and I've noticed a major slowdown after talking my service provider about this slowdown. He said it's probably interference with neighboring Wi-Fis, and he's suggesting I go to a G type of modem. I'm wondering what you guys think about that.
So, I'm sorry. So, you've got your DSL at your house, and you then have a Wi-Fi access point connected to
it. Correct.
And recently it slowed down?
No, I've just gone from Ethernet, straight DSL Ethernet,
gotcha,
a hard patch, and upgraded to an airport on my 2 Macs that
and,
I use
and
now.
And is the airport you bought a relatively new airport?
Brand new computer, brand new airport.
Okay. First off, the speed at which the Ethernet runs versus the Wi-Fi is drastically different. Wi-Fi is always a lot slower. But the DSL line shouldn't be much faster than the Wi-Fi. So it's probably...
The DSL line should be slower than the Wi-Fi.
Right, that's what I mean. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
The DSL line shouldn't be faster than the Wi-Fi. So it shouldn't affect your speed. So that's why they're suggesting that there's probably some interference with the Wi-Fi. And it's definitely true that could happen. You can have collisions. You have the same channel being used by other Wi-Fi providers in the area. And sometimes they won't even spit out their IDs, the Wi-Fi IDs. So you won't, by default, know that they're there.
Well, how about this? I live right across the street from the Navy School, the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. So I'm assuming there's a couple addresses there that they're not Navy.
Yeah, they probably have a Wi-Fi network running. I mean, it wouldn't be surprising to me.
Right.
So there are some diagnostic tools to find out if the Wi-Fi access point is if the Wi-Fi is clear in that area. It's not it's a kind of geeky thing to get into to find out what's going on with your bandwidth, if you will.
Yeah, and you wouldn't want to move to a G router. So. It would be an N router.
You'd want to go an N router.
Something that supports 5 gigahertz.
N router, yeah. It's a 5 gigahertz connection rather than the
2.4.
Thank you. So one thing you want to do, though, is plug in when you're having this problem, plug in your Mac directly to the back of the Ethernet ports. See if the speed is still okay. It could be that you had a coincidental change, right? The other thing is when you plug into your network with one of your computers, and you turn off the Wi-Fi, and then the other one you have Wi-Fi on, with Bonjour and two Macs, you should be able to see each other's the machine. Try to transfer a file there. Then you're testing very specifically. You're testing the Wi-Fi. These are just a couple suggestions I've got.
Oh, so you're saying literally transfer just like whatever, an attachment, an email from, I'm using an iMac to my MacBook Pro?
Yeah, connect to them via file sharing. You've got to go into the sharing preference panes to turn that on. But the reason that would be neat is that you'd be able to determine how long it takes to do that. And you can do that through the network connected through Ethernet, or you can do it through the Wi-Fi and kind of test it. These are just ways of kind of getting a feel for what's going on. The other thing is, in your airport, make sure that your channel selection is automatic, not that it's set to channel 6 or something like that. Make sure it's automatic, because the routers are relatively smart about trying to find a channel that's available that you can use. So these are just a few suggestions for me.
Okay, give me that last one real quick, because I wrote it down and I don't know if I caught it.
Of course, the Geek Speak is always available about a half an hour after the show online at geekspeak.org, but the Wi-Fi access channel that you want to use, there's what is it, 12 channels, 6 channels? I don't remember.
12.
12?
I think.
Nah, is it? I don't know. Anyway, you want to do channel, and you can specify like channel 6 or channel 1. The other thing you can do is do automatic, and that means the router will try to find one that's not being used in that space and switch to that. Good
great.
Luck.
Oh, Jade. By the way.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening.
Have a great day.
Thank you, you too.
It's funny, I was thinking, aren't there 11 channels? We don't know.
Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses. Tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specialize in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, and virtualization and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Janice of Santa Cruz and the Cabrillo College Human Services Department co-sponsors culturally focused treatment serving our diverse community Friday, September 23rd at Cabrillo College. Topics include how to provide treatment to vets, the homeless, the formerly incarcerated, those with HIV, victims of child sexual abuse, and LGBT populations. Information and registration materials are available at janicesantacruz.org or janicesc.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Santa Cruz, we're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Everything we talk about on GeekSpeak is available for your perusal and interest. Years of content, if you will, is available at geekspeak.org. The geeks today were Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
And Mr. Miles Elam. Miles, congratulations on 11 years of GeekSpeak. You sucker.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for being here. And answering the phones is Rick Philman. My name's Lyle Troxell. Coming up next is Car Talk with Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.